Last night, I told you how the regular Baptist movement began 100 years ago. Tonight, I would like to give you an idea of where the GARBC came from. In order to understand that story, you have to go back in your minds to a time just 90 years ago. 1919, the Northern Baptist Convention, right after World War I, was meeting in the city of Denver. There had been some ambiguity for years over the theological direction of the Northern Baptist Convention. People could sense that something was wrong, but they didn't know quite what. As a matter of fact, the convention had been founded not by Bible believers, but in 1907 by theological liberals, apostates, modernists, out of the New University of Chicago Divinity School. And now, after World War I, it finally became evident what direction the leadership of the convention wanted to go. Because in 1919, in the Denver Convention, the leadership of the convention took specific actions that left no question at all about the liberal agenda of the convention leadership. Immediately, there was a reaction that swept all the way across the convention. Probably the first individual whose voice was heard was a young pastor in Pennsylvania by the name of Robert Ketchum, who led his church to vote not to support the convention's new program. And he authored a little pamphlet to explain to the people in his church why they would not be supporting the convention's program. Well, somehow, W.B. Riley of Minneapolis, First Baptist Church, got a hold of a copy of that pamphlet, and he contacted Ketchum, and he said, "Would you mind if I had this reprinted so that other people could see it?" Ketchum said, "No, I wouldn't mind." And by the time the 1920 convention came around, W.B. Riley had sent tens of thousands of those pamphlets throughout the entire Northern Baptist Convention. One other thing had happened. Actually, two other things had happened in the meanwhile. First, three old friends put their heads together. The three were Oliver W. Van Osdell of Wealthy Street Baptist Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan, William L. Pettengill, and you may remember we heard about Van Osdell last night, William L. Pettengill and R.E. Niebuhr, who was an evangelist. They put their heads together and they said, "It has become clear that the Northern Baptist Convention is corrupt. It has been betrayed theologically. It's time to begin leading a movement to come out of the Northern Baptist Convention." And they began to plan an organization. But as word got out, they were contacted by a pastor from New York by the name of J.C. Massey. And Massey said to them, "Gentlemen, would you please hold off for a short while on your organization? There are some of us who would like to get together to see whether we could clean up the convention from inside." And so Van Osdell said, we'll stay out of your way until we discover whether or not it works to clean up the convention from inside. And so Van Osdell and Pettengill and Niebuhr backed away, and Massey took charge with an organization that came to be known as the Fundamentalist Fellowship. And what they would do is to meet the week before the convention every year, plan a strategy, and go into the convention in the effort to try to do damage to the liberals who were in control of the Northern Baptist Convention. In 1920, they went in with a proposal to sell the denominational magazine. It was called The Baptist. Ketchum once observed, "The first squawk it ever gave was on Baptistic." Well, the motion was to sell The Baptist. And somebody stood up from the liberal side and said, "We make a motion that this be laid on the table for another year." And so it was tabled. There was a motion to investigate the schools and another motion to table, and everything was laid on the table. And they left the convention really having accomplished nothing in 1920. They went back in 1921 and they said, "What we need to do is to adopt a convention of faith." There was a fellow by the name of Frank Goodchild who had written a very brief confession, and they agreed, "This year we're going to put the Goodchild Confession on the floor of the convention and try to get people to vote on this." Well, it was Massey's job to make the motion, and for some reason he just never made it. And so they left in 1921 having accomplished nothing. In 1922, the convention was meeting in Indianapolis, and they got to the pre-convention meeting, the fundamental fellowship, and everybody was a bit disturbed with Massey for not having made the motion the year before. And Massey said, well, he said, I couldn't see putting a motion on the floor that had just been written out by one of our own fellows. Well, somebody said, then we need an older confession of faith. We need something that all Baptists agree to. Somebody said, well, how about the New Hampshire Confession? Well, does anybody have a copy? That happened. Joshua Gravett from Denver had a copy, and he stood up and he read through the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, and the record indicates that by the time he had read through the entire confession, now when you think about reading a confession of faith, this isn't for amusement, right? But by the time Gravett had finished reading that confession, there wasn't a dry eye in the room. And these men were saying, this is what we believe. This is what we need. Put this on the floor, but we're not going to let Massey do it this year. They said, Riley, you take it. You make the motion. And so Riley did. He stood up on the floor of the convention. He read the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, and he made the motion that the Northern Baptist Convention receive the New Hampshire Confession of Faith as its own statement of faith. Almost immediately, Cornelius Wolfkin from New York stood up and offered a substitute motion. And his substitute motion was that the Northern Baptist Convention affirm that the New Testament is our sufficient confession of faith and we need no other statement. Now you realize what Wolfkin is doing. If you're going to vote for the New Hampshire Confession, you've got to vote against the New Testament. Who's going to do that? And as it turned out, the motion went down in flames. Well, at this point, Van Asdel, Niebuhr, Pettengill said, all right, guys, you've had your fun. You've taken your best shot at it. It's clear that nothing has changed inside the convention, and so we are moving ahead with the formation of a new organization, and it will be called the Baptist Bible Union. And so in 1923, the Baptist Bible Union was launched as a separate fellowship. Almost immediately, Pettengill and Niebuhr were elbowed out of leadership. Van Asdel was set in the background, and the Baptist Bible Union was taken over by three very big names: W.B. Riley out of Minneapolis, J. Frank Norris out of Fort Worth, Texas, and T.T. Shields out of Toronto, Canada. And those big three names dominated the Baptist Bible Union until 1929. For several years, they tried to use it as a platform outside the convention to try to get something going so that they could get the liberals out of the Northern Baptist Convention. Everything came to a head in 1927 when the convention was meeting in Chicago. And it was a late night meeting of the Baptist Bible Union right before the Northern Baptist Convention was to begin. And somebody said, what we really need to do is to elect a slate of true Bible-believing officers in the convention. If we could do that, we could get somewhere. And somebody else said, well, then let's just offer a substitute nomination for every name on the slate. Well, R.T. Ketchum, who was at that time pastor of this church, stood up and said, men, he said, you know what's going to happen. If you try to offer a substitute nomination for every office on the slate, they'll just rule you out of order. I'd rule you out of order myself. He said, you can't have that kind of chaos in a public meeting. If you want to make substitute nominations, decide what your nominations are going to be and get a separate ballot printed up, and maybe they'll let you put that separate ballot on the floor. Well, since Ketchum was the one who said they ought to do it, Ketchum was the one who had to go and find a printer after midnight. And he didn't know what he was going to do, and so he's wandering the streets of Chicago, and finally he spotted a police officer. And it's about 2:00 in the morning. He says to the police officer, where can I find a printer? Well, the officer didn't know, but he had a call box right there, called around to a few other officers, and before long he'd found Ketchum an all-night printer. Went in, got the ballots run off, and Ketchum walked into the convention meeting just as the election was about to take place, just in time to have the substitute ballot floated before the floor of the convention. The chairman allowed it, so you had two ballots you could vote for, one on white paper if you wanted the convention ballot, the other on green paper, I believe it was, if you wanted the Baptist Bible Union ballot. And the Baptist Bible Union ballot went down in flames. Over 800 in deficit of winning the election. It seemed pretty clear at that point that nothing else was going to happen in the Northern Baptist Convention. That was the day that R.T. Ketchum said to himself, "I'm not coming back." And he never did go back to the Northern Baptist Convention. And it looked virtually certain that finally a separation was about to take place and that the Baptist Bible Union was going to blow a trumpet and set up an outside organization to provide a forum for fellowship among fundamental Baptists. But in 1927, right after the Northern Baptist Convention, T.T. Shields got a telephone call from the board at Des Moines University. Des Moines University wasn't the same university that exists by that name today. It was a university that was owned by the Baptists of the state of Iowa. And they said to Shields, "We've got an indebtedness of about $200,000, but if the Baptist Bible Union will take over the debt, you can have the university." And Shields said, "This is just too good a chance to pass up. A fundamentalist university, that could be the world's most unusual thing." And so fundamentalists got their very own university, Des Moines University. But the problem was that there were a number of people on the staff and faculty who were modernists. And even the ones who weren't modernists had been able to live and work happily with modernists on the faculty. So under Baptist Bible Union administration, there was constant tension within Des Moines University over the next 2 years. Things began to spiral downhill. They took measures to try to correct the downhill spiral. Nothing seemed to work. Things went from bad to worse. And finally, in the spring of 1929, the students of Des Moines University erupted in one of the first student riots in the United States of America, and it happened in a fundamentalist institution. They hanged the president in effigy. A group of kids went down to the local hatchery and said to the guy at the hatchery, "Do you know where we can buy some rotten eggs?" And the guy, of course, says, "We don't sell rotten eggs, wink, wink. We store them out back." So they got all they wanted. They broke windows. They smeared the entire campus with rotten eggs. The doors were closed, and the institution never reopened. So by the time you come to July of 1929, just 80 years ago, Des Moines University is in shambles. And with Des Moines University, the Baptist Bible Union is in shambles. And you're saying, "You told us that you were going to talk about where the GARB came from. Where does that come into the picture?" Come back tomorrow night. And I'll tell you, okay? In the meanwhile, we do have actually more important things to discuss this evening.